to another episode of Inside the Recording Studio. I am Jody Whitesides, and with me, as always, is Mr. Chris Hellstrom. How are you today, Chris?
I'm fantastic, Jody. How are you?
I'm not quite as fantastic as you, maybe, but I'm doing all right, too.
All right. Yeah, you're a little stuttery there. Probably a hint to what we're about to talk about.
That's right.
Because what are we talking about today?
Groove editing for grid purposes.
Yeah. How much to slam to the grid or not to slam to the grid, and how do we make some of those decisions?
That's right.
At least in our minds. This is something I think a lot of people struggle with, and it's easy to see why, I believe. See why is there a big hint to why, I think. But this is also something that you came across, and we both felt that this would be a good subject for a podcast, in that you have done a massive undertaking of a lot of remixing and stuff.
Yes.
Should you time correct everything? Jody, you answer yes or no.
Get ready to pull up a glass. It depends.
Yeah.
Take a shot. Take a shot. Because it depends on the source material and what your goal and accomplishment is in terms of what are you doing it for? That's how I would ask the question. That's how I'm asking the question of myself in going through all of this remixing is, do I wish to go George Lucas and put things in that I didn't have the wherewithal to do originally or the capability of doing originally?
Wait, was that a Star Wars reference?
It was.
I think it was.
That was a Star Wars reference.
The answer then becomes, like, should you really slam everything to the grid? And I think we can both safely say that in most cases, no. You shouldn't necessarily do that. I mean, I think there are certain stylistic things where that kind of needs to be. Let's say that you're doing like EDM or something. You're probably more inclined to do it in that sort of musical situation as opposed to a jazz quartet or something.
Right.
Sometimes that might be appropriate. Let's say in your case here, when you're doing more of a pop rock thing, and I guess we'll start from the ground up and start talking about drums.
Yes.
Because you had some pretty cool drummers playing on this.
Well, I've had quite a few good drummers across all the albums of things that I have done, which has been a fortunate reality for me. It's awesome that you can be friends with somebody and be able to go into the studio and make sure that not only do they sound good when they're doing it, or at least you're hoping everything's sounding good.
You do the best with what you got.
You do the best with what you got at the time, yes. The drummers that I played with the exception of one, didn't really have a problem so much with timing, which is great. That doesn't mean little slip-ups don't occur, because they're human, as are we. And if you're human, it's extremely hard to be perfectly on the grid without any faltering in the playing.
Yeah, this is a relatively new phenomenon, obviously, with the advent of recording to a DAW.
Which is really beat detective and time correction in that regard.
Sure, because we actually see it and it's visually, oh, look at that, you're a little bit off here. But if you're just listening to it, you wouldn't notice. Sure, you could be playing to a click track and you can notice that it's severely drifting out of time, even if you're not recording into a DAW. But it is something I think more people are concerned with now.
Sure.
Before a DAW, it would be more like, this drummer has a hard time keeping time or whatever. Mm-hmm. Probably not get called back very often because of it. It's those decisions that we have to make. So when you're, you know, working with the drummer, let's say on this last project, where do you stand that when you're listening to the performance initially, do you have a mindset of, I'm going to see where it needs to be time corrected? And if so, where and how hard? Or do you just listen and go, that sounds a little bit weird to me. That sounds a little bit off. I'm going to pull that back in time.
Well, here's the difficulty that I am setting up in terms of doing this. This last album, which is the last of all the ones that I'm working on, was written using loops. And those loops have certain timing discrepancies in them. I didn't chop them up and time correct them. All the parts were recorded to clicks and these loops prior to the drummer stepping into a booth and doing the recording.
These, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Jerry, but the loops that you're talking about now, the written to a loop, were these sort of like drum loops, or were they just more like percussive or other loops that were ended up being integral to the arrangement?
Mostly drums and percussion.
Okay.
I don't tend to use musical loops very often. It's
no, I
meant,
but if
rare.
There was like a keyboard line or something.
Right, yeah,
was,
I don't
but,
do
but,
that.
But these were all rhythmic drummer.
Yeah, drummer-based type things. And whether they were straight-up drums or they had some kind of weird sonic quality to them, they were still drum-related or rhythmically related. Thus, the drummers that have been used across these projects all had to work on playing to these things, which makes it difficult. Not an easy thing to do, especially if the groove is constantly changing in a sense, with loops changing from one part to another. It makes it a difficult process. In the matter of time and technology at the time they were done, it's more difficult to have done it then than it is now in terms of time correcting the drummers.
What time frame are we talking about? When did this album initially get released?
What, 2008, 7, 8, somewhere in that range?
Yeah. Okay.
So it's not extremely late. It's not extremely early. There was decent technology. It just wasn't where it is now, obviously, almost 20 years later. It's a lot better now than it was then. Part of it is detaching myself from it. It's when I originally did it, it's like, it's not changing ever. And I do remember.
You gotta be objective now, right?
Yeah, now I can be more objective about it. And one of the songs, which is actually one of my favorites, the groove on it, even if playing it live changed by a quarter of a BPM, made the song completely fall apart to me. And I still believe that with that song, but now at least I can manipulate what the live drums are doing so it doesn't sound as flammy and as loose as I let it be in the original release. I wanted it to be much more tight, and now it's possible to make it that.
Mm. So when you're working with these tracks now, you said there you got some flamming in the original one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that's in between
the live drums and the loops.
Right.
Yeah.
How do you go about fixing that? The obvious thing that I think most people would do, they would, in whatever DAW you're in, mark the beats and just put them straight on the grid. I'm understanding you're not doing that. You're using one as the reference. So are you then manipulating the live drums?
Yes.
Into, now you're not doing that to the grid. You're doing it to like a groove template in the loop. Is that the way that you're doing it? Or
No.
Okay.
No. The recordings as done used overhead mics with live cymbals, live hi-hat. The toms, the kick, and the snare were all using electronic kit pieces.
Oh, so this is still the V-drum
setup. This is the V-drum setup, but with live cymbals and live hi-hats.
Got it.
Okay. Which makes it easier and maybe a little harder in that I have a nice stereo spectrum of what those overhead mics picked up, and I can manipulate the snare, the kick, and the toms to be whatever sounds are more appropriate for the songs. Now, at the time, drum libraries were fairly awful, not great. So I used sounds coming out of the V drums for those particular kit pieces of the toms, the kick, and the snare, which made it easy in terms of like the playback. And of course, in the episode with Charlie Clouser, we had mentioned the fact that the snare was outputting information of where on the snare hood it's hit. The V drums automatically know that. It's what they do.
Right.
But drum plugins, not so much. Although we now know that Logic Drummer actually reads that information. If it is not the rim shot, it is the snare center hit. It will read that information, which is great. In terms of how that plays out sonically, I originally recorded that left and right as two mono outputs.
Mm-hmm.
In the mix, I want to do it as a stereo track, rather than dealing with stuff. It also makes it easier to do the editing without phase issues happening if it's a stereo track. So the first thing I'm doing as I'm going through these remixes, I'm actually joining those two mono tracks into a stereo file so that they can be operated on as one. Then I have the output of the loops on another track. And I play just the loops along with just the drums. And I'm using, obviously, the new drum sounds for the kick, snare, and toms. And I'm manipulating those in the context of the song so that I'm choosing better sounding snares, better sounding kicks, and better sounding toms along with the live hits that I have. Now, in the stereo track, you can hear the of the snare
hitting on the pad.
You can hear that hitting on the tom. You can hear it hitting on the kick. But of course, when it's played together with the actual sound being triggered, you don't hear the that you would hear when you hear just the overheads, which is great. I put all that together and I run that with the loop and I'm listening for where is it getting out of whack? Because it's very difficult for a human to play like a computer. Some guys can do it fairly well, but they can't do it perfectly. Bless their souls, all of these guys, Christopher Alice, Paul, Donnie, Andy, all these guys were great drummers and super awesome for being willing to play to clicks for one and two, playing to loops as another. It's not often that drummers are probably asked to do that. And all of these guys were very much willing to do that, which is awesome. But now in doing that with these remixes, some of the stuff that made it feel slightly off in the actual release can now be tweaked. So what I'm doing is I'm running the overhead track and turning on flex time in Logic, which automatically sets up marker points. And if I don't turn on actual quantizing, it doesn't actually highlight any of those markers. And I can go in and I can listen and I can also represent the loop itself visually in the region. And I can kind of comparatively listen. If I hear something off, I can see how far ahead or how far behind. Because I can hear the push and pull of it. But how far and how much should I be moving it is all a sonic thing that I have to listen for. So when I find a spot, I will mark off the beginning of the section, whether it's a verse or a chorus, a pre-chorus, a bridge, a solo, whatever, so that it doesn't move from that point, because everything else before or after that really should be staying fairly steady. And then I mark the other end of the section, and then I work on that section individually if there's something off, and I try to find the smallest point of where it's getting off so that I can put markers before and after that to not affect everything else around it.
What you're describing is that you're not going like beat by beat and kind of correcting everything. It's more like you're noticing where something is kind of out and tweaking as needed.
Yes.
From an audio perspective, where it noticeably isn't
as locked as it should be.
Right.
Or as locked as I want it to be. Not that it should be, but just as locked as I envisioned it to be.
Right.
And in that regard, yes, it is not beat by beat. But am I listening beat by beat? You're damn right I am.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, but here's an issue and sort of like the topic for this whole episode, I think, is the temptation, I think, is for most people, again, is to just go in and quantize everything.
Yes.
And have it to the grid. And it's not like that doesn't have its advantages at some point. Sometimes the listener also expects that and can kind of feel that. But I'm reminded of a story here. It's a good friend of mine was a session drummer, and he would be called to apply his feel, right? And he would often say that, yeah, you got called because they liked his feel or whatever. But then they would put Beat Detective on it once he left and slam it to the grid. So the question to me is like, well, why the fuck did they call you in the first place? Right?
Because you're gonna maybe just to record slam the drums fast. Who knows?
Right. Well, he's a great drummer.
Right.
But you can lose so much with that. So you were describing to me how you would create these like groove templates also in Logic and kind of quantizing to that.
Yes. So as to continue to, with the process
yeah,
on that.
Go ahead.
The idea here is that once I've got those corrections made so that things line up a little tighter, that obviously pulls the of the snare, the kick, the toms that hit slightly off from where the MIDI notes are.
Yeah.
So now I have to make a groove template of that overhead track. Mm-hmm. And then I have to apply that groove template to the MIDI. That's a fairly easy thing to do. And of course, you mentioned just slamming a guy to a grid. That's the cheap, easy way out. I could have done the same thing, and then I could have probably quantized the loops as well so that everything was on the grid. That would destroy the feel of what was originally intended in the recording to me, right? Now, once I've made that groove template from having done the edits, so things aren't flamming as much as I initially had, I have to still go back and listen to, are those hits hitting correctly? Because occasionally the groove template will still not quite quantize it where it should be, which is weird. I don't know why that is. It's just something that happens. It's the mathematical things of what it does.
Yeah, errors happen in the analyzation.
So you still have to
listen
and you still have to mess around with things, which is all well and good. On one particular song, the drummer was pushing a bit and he was pulling a bit in different sections. So that's
on purpose,
which is, that's what you should do. I mean, that's all of how you create tension and release in music, along with the melodic aspect of things, is the pushing and pulling of time. Thus, I had to be very conscious of, in this section, no matter what I do, I can't go right to the grid with it. I have to pull it back off the beat a little bit, or I have to push it forward of the beat a little bit to make sure that it doesn't lose the groove value that was being intended by the drummer and still get it to lock up in certain spots with the loop that was there, because the loop was essentially doing the same thing. The drummer was following that vibe. That's an important thing to be distinctive about. And it's not easy. It's time consuming. It's taking sometimes on average 4 hours per track to do these edits for that. And that's,
it's a lot,
but it sounds great.
Yeah. It pays off in the end. Right. And then now of course you have a groove track and you can apply the same type of processing for
all the other instruments,
the other instrument
guitars,
tracks, right?
Bass, keys, what have you. Although in applying that to certain other instruments, and we'll kind of gloss over that in relation to this, at least I will, you still have to go listen to that instrument because it might pull two notes in two different directions and completely screw up what the playing had intended there as well. So you still have to correct the quantizing of other instruments, which again leads to you're using your ears and making sure that it sounds right and the groove is retained.
Yeah. And of course, you're mentioning all of these with being recorded with MIDI, essentially through the V drums and everything. But the same thing applies, obviously, if you get a live kit.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just a different problem. But the timing thing is the most important part. When it comes to taking kit pieces and applying to time, let's say that you have, it's not a remixing situation, but you have a drum track performed by live drummer, ideally all separated out on the different kit pieces.
Uh-huh.
Where do you place most of your focus? On what kit pieces do you focus primarily on the time? These should all be phase locked, so you're adjusting everything equally, or you end up with a mess when it comes to phasing. But do you start with just kick, and then, or do you focus on the snare? What do you tend to do?
I look at the underlying groove. A lot of things these days, obviously 4/4, and a lot of it is kick on 1 and 3, snare on 2 and 4. That's the general reality of now. Things change over time. There are other times when things can be offbeat or what have you, but I tend to focus on where is the crux of the groove and then the crux of the section of the song. So for sections, I'm looking for the downbeat or where the section changes with a crash and possibly a kick as well. So those will line up pretty much to define where the section starts and ends. Then here's inside, one, yeah, to yeah. the one or wherever that would happen to be.
Wherever it is, right? Yeah.
With the rest of it, I'm quantizing as a whole. And fortunately, with the live overheads, you can see pretty much everything in the overheads as it should be.
You mean that you can see,
you see the kick, you can see the snare, you can see the crashes and such. I don't worry so much about the hi-hats unless something is completely mishit on that. And it happens once in a great while, so you have to pay attention to the hi-hat feel as well. I do recall one song in doing this where the live drummer was absolutely awful. It took 80 takes, and then I had to make sure that those 80 takes made sense from one piece to another, and then I had to time correct those 80 takes. Not time correct all 80 takes, but you make take folders, you make the entire song, and then you stem it out, and then you time correct it. It was a
then
pain in the ass.
Then
you lose all objectivity, yes. But in doing that, that drummer was so bad that some of the time corrections in between the hit of his hi-hat or his crash and his actual hit of his kick would cause things to be compressed or expanded so much to get to the proper location of where it needed to be, that it caused glitching and weird anomalies in the sound, which then have to be covered up using samples. Most of it was live on, this is not one of my songs, it was something, a song that I worked on, and they really wanted it to be a certain feel, and the drummer just didn't have the wherewithal to be able to pull this off. So can you do it?
The drummer was?
No, I don't want to out him. It's not nice. No. But the idea there is that you can do this to get to a point, but if you make timing corrections that are way absurd, you're going to have to figure out ways to get around the artifacts that occur. Now, fortunately for the things that I'm working on, I don't have that issue. They're so slight for most of them that it just feels tighter and you don't even hear the fact that it's been time corrected in terms of any kind of artifacts or glitching. But the bigger thing at the end of all of this is, if it's not a song that's meant to be four on the floor, dance has to be perfect all the time, don't assume that everything needs to be specifically right on the grid.
Yeah.
Just don't assume that.
Right. Take something as, it's an absurd comparison, but it makes the point. It's like, again, at the top, I mentioned like an EDM track compared to like a loose jazz thing. Well, the EDM is probably going to be very, very similar in BPM count at the end of the track as a downbeat of one.
Yeah.
The jazz track is not.
No.
Because it's going to have like, it's going to travel and go somewhere. It's going to speed up. It might slow down. It's going to end up in a completely different place, right?
Yes.
And as energy builds, it might be as much as like 10 to 15 BPM different, right? And sure, you can program that, but that's hard. It's better to keep the natural feel of the drummer in most cases. So going on the grid there would just ruin things, wouldn't it, really? Having said that, though, these examples that you bring up, we need to make the distinction of, is this a drummer that plays with the feel and the push and pull versus just being out of time?
Yes, there's a big difference there. And the drummer that I mentioned that I had to correct in absurd amounts, that's just not a good drummer. And requiring other aspects of things.
I've found in my experience when I do this, and let's say that there's some time manipulation going on, okay? I tend to focus primarily on the kick and see where that lines up on the bar. If that starts drifting too much after like one or two bars, you pull that into time a little bit right there and then, just to kind of retain that feel. Things like hi-hat and stuff should fall into place pretty quickly if you're dealing with live drums and you have that all the way through. But again, I don't go like super anal and try to time correct every hi-hat stroke. If it's a part that's flubbed, chances are there's a better take somewhere else in the song that you can just kind of fly that in. I don't go with the grid thing either. I want to touch briefly before we round off today about other instruments as well as we're dealing with this. Because you obviously had different instrumentation in this song. We've kind of talked about the percussion, the rhythmic loop type of thing. So I think that is well covered. What about guitars or keys or anything like that? How anal do you get with that?
Same. I look at them After the drums are done, I then pull in the bass so that I understand where the bass is pushing and pulling on the groove of the drums having been time corrected. So I have to look at all the where little time corrections occurred and see what happens with that. Then once I've done the bass and the drums, I move on to the guitars, I move on to the other instruments, and finally with the vocals at the end. Because all of it will eventually need to be massaged a little bit, but I don't immediately turn on
beat. It's not like turn off flex time and hit quantize and everything is fine and dandy.
Right.
Yeah. One thing that I find interesting as well is when you have things like guitar or bass that you're trying to massage into place against the drums, the temptation can be as well as like trying to do this with your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to like line up transients. In my experience, that can almost make more harm than good, right? Because you can get all sorts of like phase cancellation and stuff, especially between like kick and bass and those type of things, because they tend to live in the same frequency range, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also things where a bass and guitar are doing a similar figure. You have to listen to that. It takes a little bit for them to be severely out of time, but to pull them exactly into time again is probably not going to give you the results that you're looking for.
Chances are.
You share that as well? So that's good. I'm not completely off my rocker here then.
No, you're not off your rocker. But we should move on to our Friday finds. Chris, what have you got this week?
A new piece of, well, it's not a new piece of software. It's a new piece of software for me that I was turned on to that I use to great effect these days. And it's something called Keyboard Maestro.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember on the Mac, there used to be something called the Automator.
They still have it.
You could automate tasks. And this thing is freaking fantastic if you need to do like repetitive stuff, like renaming, let's say 90 tracks with a certain syntax, and you got to do that several times in a session. You can automate that. So you hit a button and boom, it does whatever you want. So very, very cool. Keyboard Maestro. Just do a search for Keyboard Maestro. It's a cheap piece of software because it's going to save you a bunch of time. That is my find for this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And Jody, what do you have?
I'm going with a floor pedal for guitar players or just anybody in general that likes to use foot pedals. It is the Wannabe by Beatronics. It is a distortion pedal that has the values of a Klon and a Blues Breaker pedal within it.
It has, what an excellent name.
Right, the Wannabe.
The Wannabe.
By Beatronics. It has three knobs for each section. Three knobs for the Klon, three knobs for the Blues Breaker, and then it has switches in between that allows you to route the signal or mesh the two of them together. So you can start with the input of the Blues Breaker and go to the tone factor of the Klon to the distortion of something else, or you can do the opposite, or there's a lot of different combinations that you can do. Thus, I'm going with the Wannabe from Beatronics for this week.
Nice.
While we've got your attention, we ask that you go to insidetherecordingstudio.com and sign up for our mailing list. You'll need to be on our email list in order to be eligible for any giveaways, and we'll make sure that you don't miss any future episodes of this insanely cool podcast. Send us an email at goldstar, GOLDSTAR, at insidetherecordingstudio.com with the word grid, and you'll get something cool back in your inbox. If you have a topic or suggestion for Chris and I to explain in a future episode, contact us at the contact page and we'll put it into consideration for a future episode. With that, I'll see you next week.
Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.